are listening to The Caregivers with Lon Kiefer.
Hey there. Yeah, you. I'm talking to you. You might be a caregiver. Hey, I don't know. You might not even know. Welcome home to the Caregivers Podcast, where you're never alone. Thank you for being here, and hopefully this podcast is giving you a reason to stay and to say thank you for caring. My name is Lon Kiefer, and I am a caregiver. I'm also your host, and as I'm sure you know by now, I'm widely known as Doc, the Defender of Caregivers. You can find us at The Caregivers Podcast on Facebook, and over on Twitter, we are at Caregivers Pod. For those of you that don't know what we're doing here, we're talking to the caregivers of the world, whether they be professional or personal family caregivers, in an effort to make certain no one is ever alone on their caregiver's journey, even if your companion is just a voice in a podcast. Our guest today is one of those, hey, he's not a caregiver type of guests, but I would propose that he is. He's an attorney with an interest in self-protection, situational awareness, and in the end, overall, caregiver safety. And much of his interest was fueled vicariously through his observations and experiences of his professional caregiver wife, a home health nurse of 30 plus years. Please join me as we discuss personal and caregiver safety with Pietro Barbieri.
Pietro, I can't thank you enough for doing this. Is it Pietro?
Peter. Yes. I grew up, I was given that name by my parents. It is my grandfather's name. And quick aside, if my parents...
There's going to be a few of those, aren't there?
Yeah. if I heard Pietro out of my father or my mother's mouth, I knew that whatever I was doing was wrong.
So this whole time that I have forced myself to call you Pietro because I thought it was a respectful thing, I've been treating you like a little boy that got his hand caught in the cookie jar.
I've come to love that name.
Oh, well, listen, before we get too deep into your caregiver story, please take a moment to honor yourself before you share with others. Please tell us about yourself briefly and where we can find you and that sort of thing.
I am an attorney. I have been for 41 years.
One of those, huh?
Actually, I'm a good attorney. And I challenge your listeners to look at the logo on my website. And if you can tell me why it's there, I will mail you a free Starbucks coffee. How's that?
How are you going to mail a Starbucks coffee? Maybe we'll send them a gift certificate for a
Starbucks coffee.
I'm going to keep you honest here. I'm going to keep you from overcommitting here. Yeah, so I'm looking at your website now. It's a lion with eagle's wings?
That is correct.
I got no clue, so
I'm not telling you. You have to figure it out if you want to get the gift card.
I mean, I have to buy my own coffee. Can you give us your website?
Yes, it's trustpointlegalgroup.com. It tries to give you, the listener, a feeling of who we are.
Yeah. Well, let me take the reins just for a minute here, because I don't want people to think that you're just a lawyer. I mean, you're a great lawyer. You've been a good friend of mine. We met through caregiving, extension of caregiving, and you and I were together on a program that we did for the public about caregiver safety. And the first challenge was getting the public to understand what we were going to be talking about, because it's such a broad topic. And you did an excellent job of helping people to understand the angle.
I'm going to cut you off there, because it's not a job. It's a advocation for me. Mm-hmm. And if you'd like me to explain that, I can tell you why.
Sure.
Back in the day, my wife and I had little or nothing between us. And the job...
You mean financially? Oh, I thought you meant you didn't really care for her.
Oh, no. No, she was the love of my life. She was the love of my life from 15 years old. But we had little or nothing in terms of finances, and it was a tough way to go. She had to give up a lot. One of the things she did, though, that she loved was being a home health care provider. She did that for the city of Philadelphia, and then when we moved out to Chester County, she did it for a private organization. Back in the day, home health care providers, she wore her Columboized blue dress with her Columboized raincoat, and the community saw her as an asset. They saw her as part of the family to help others within the community. Over the 40 subsequent years, things have changed. Things have changed dramatically. Caregivers, home caregivers, are not seen as the community participant. They're being seen as conduits. They're being seen as conduits and victims, victims of crime, conduits to drugs, paraphernalia, and other things that are become epidemic in this country, sadly have become epidemic in this country. And so it has become an advocation. I don't want people to stop being caregivers. It's needed and necessary in our society. As we get older as a society, it's more needed and necessary. They need to be protected, though. They need to be able to protect themselves and not be presented as victims.
Yeah, the Washington Post has an article out sometime in the recent past that one of America's most dangerous jobs is that of being a nurse or a social worker. And I can give you a personal story. This is about you, but I'll validate what you're saying. 25 years ago-ish, I moved from the greater Baltimore area down to a rural town called Seaford, Delaware. And I was working for Nanticoke Health Services, and I was responsible for all the outreach. I had physician recruitment and management of the physician practices, home health, which is to your story, and several other things. But with home health, right at the time that I was moving, you want to talk about a great family decision, 2020 had an expose on Crack Alley, the cocaine epidemic of America, and Crack Alley was Seaford, Delaware, 3rd and North, which was the town that I was deciding to move my
familiar with
to.
It, very.
So Seaford was a great town otherwise, but this one particular corner was featured on national news. And within a month or two of going there, running the home health agency, one of my nurses had to go to Crack Alley. And I've always, all my life, everybody said, are you a cop? You know, I'm a bald white guy. You know, that apparently for, I think I'm funny, but I can have a scowl on my face, partially because of my vision is bad in the sunlight and what have you. I get it everywhere I go. You look like a cop. So when she went to 3rd and North, I followed her to make sure she would be safe. Well, the person that was not safe in that neighborhood at that moment was me, because the neighbors came around and they said, what are you doing? Why are you following that nurse around? She's here taking care of Miss Alice. We got her back. What are you doing here? So it
Absolutely.
Was a different time then than now.
So. Absolutely. She was seen as the angel in blue coming to the community again to help Miss Alice, to help Miss Betty, who was getting through a difficult time. Now that's not the case. There are means to a end, and the end is drugs and paraphernalia. For some reason, they're perceived as being that person. In fact, at the seminar that we gave, one of the participants said that being kind, she routinely went and picked up her client's pain medication. And I admonished her. I said, no, you can't do that, or you have to you have to stop it, because you now, it's going to be known on the street that that's what you're doing, and you may never get back to your client's home. Yeah. So things have changed.
Yeah. There's a bill before the House now about caregivers and protecting them. In 2016, I'm reading, healthcare and social service workers suffered 69% of all workplace violence injuries, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and were nearly five times, get this, five times more likely to experience violence in the job than the average U.S. worker. They're more likely to get injured at work than even police officers and prison guards.
All right. I think you stole that from my seminar. But I'm not saying.
Did you quote that as well?
I quoted that exact same thing. I'm not saying. I'm just saying.
Hey, you can't get all the nuggets for the listening audience. I've got to have a little bit of stuff to share here.
Okay.
But it's real. I see it all the time. Listen, one of the challenges that I'm going to have with this podcast is that I have a broader view of the term caregiver than most people do. And, you know, this will find an audience or it won't. But these things are very important to me as I walk through my life. And I really value what you shared that day. You're going to do a much better job of this than I am. But I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about situational awareness. And I'm not even sure that that's the right term to use, but here's why I want to do this. And I think even you struggled initially why this really meant so much to me. One of the things you talk about, and I'm going to let you talk about it in a second, is how you want to control your environment. Well, if you're stepping into the caregiver role as a professional, or it's thrust upon you as a family caregiver, you have very little control over your environment. You have to be where the care is occurring. You have to be with the person that is receiving it.
Absolutely.
You don't have control over your personal space and situation. So can you talk to me a little bit about situational awareness?
Situational awareness is, and I wish we had a video that we could show, but the quintessential is an individual walking down a New York street. She is texting or on her cell phone, and an elevator door opens up in the sidewalk, as anyone who may be familiar with New York does, so they can bring in product. And without seeing, she fell right over the door, down a flight of steps, and got very seriously injured, totally unaware that of her surroundings. And I'm saying, as we go into more of a techno society, we tend to put the earbuds in our ears and turn off the world. Well, you can't do that, okay? You're becoming a victim. In fact, about 9 weeks ago, a podcast, a very successful podcast entertainer, was run over by a train.
Holy crap. I'm fearing for my life right now. I'm stepping into this podcast world, and I'm going to – I didn't hear this.
Okay. His name was Doc Thompson. He had finished his show, and he needed some time to clear his brain, so he went jogging. He put his earbuds in his ear and turned up the volume, as he is occasioned to do, on his favorite music, and never heard the train behind him. He was running along train tracks.
Yeah.
And the train was blowing its whistle furiously, but he never heard it. He got run over, and that was the end of that.
So the irony of this story and of life is how small the world is and how things are interconnected. One of the stories that I tell to talk about should statements, which is a cognitive distortion. It's you think that I should do this, I should do that, and I say from the stage that you have a shouldy attitude. Is that this is one of the distortions, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. But when you're stressed or conflicted, you can think poorly. And I tell the story about I should go for a jog, and you should argue, no, I shouldn't go for a jog. And I tell a story similar to that about dying while jogging and that sort of thing. So I'm going to start that story instead of the one that I use now. But while we're talking about this and situational awareness, I bought a truck recently. The other day when I was looking at one of the trucks I did not buy, I had already called for an Uber while I'm talking to the guy and trying to leave him. Situational awareness. We get caught up in the moment so much. While I'm talking to him, a car pulls up and parks right behind me. And I'm saying goodbye to him, trying to leave, just wanting to exit. And I go to the back door of this car and I open it up. And there's this blanket with dog hair everywhere. And I'm thinking, this is the crappiest Uber driver I've ever met in my life. But because I was caught up in the moment and thinking distracted, I got into this car and shut the door. And this woman looks at me. The car salesman guy looks at her, shrugs his shoulders. They both look at me. I got in a personal vehicle. I did not get in an Uber. And the guy said, I think the Uber that, you want is right there on the corner. Now,
that happens. And it's happened. Actually, it was made a story very similar that just made the news about a week ago.
Yeah.
And that had a little more of a tragic ending instead of a silly lift.
She got in a non-Uber while looking at her phone and didn't realize. So let's get back on the rails because you and I both will run off the rails. The rails are that the cell phone was the distraction. Me getting away from the car salesman was a distraction, but caregivers.
And the
responsibility and the burden is a distraction that causes us to be vulnerable.
Absolutely. And that is what a caregiver needs to practice. This is not something, situational awareness does not happen today. It happens through practice. And as my dear old dad used to say, it happens by your gut. That gut is really important. If it feels wrong, looks wrong, tastes wrong, it is. Don't question that. And we have to learn as an individual to not try to overthink. And that is our instinct today, is to be over academic, overthink things. If it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. So when you go into an environment that is not your environment, for a few seconds, start up just a few seconds. What do I smell? What do I see? What do I hear? Is it normal? If it's not normal, question it. Don't be afraid to question it. Take a look around you and see, okay, if the poo hits the fan, what options do I have?
This is a podcast. You can say poop.
In the seminar, I one of my examples, and I loved it to death. When you're doing a seminar, you're always afraid that you're going to ask people to do something and they're going to do it absolutely perfectly, in which case that stops your seminar dead cold.
Right. Because you need the reality of them doing it incorrectly. I always tease people. I said, I'm going to ask you to volunteer just so I can tell you you're wrong.
Right.
So just get over
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So in this particular instance, I asked a group of about 40 people. I said, now I need you to all close your eyes. No cheating. Everybody's going to close your eyes. And I spotted a couple cheaters, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. They want that angle.
They want that little bit of, I don't know what the prize is, but I'm going to get it. So I said, everybody's close your eyes. I said, now I want you to do is take your right and or left hand and point to the most likely exit of this room in the event that something happened.
Yeah, I remember this.
To the person. They all pointed to the big doors to the left of my person, to the left. And I said, okay, now I want everybody to open up their eyes. And on the door was a giant poster that said, this is not an exit.
And what they don't know, but you did, and I did, because you have this, you survey your area. You showed the video about the guy at the bar, at the diner, that knew everything about everybody in there. You knew because that's in you, because you practice it. And I knew because I was involved in helping to run that. Beyond that door that they thought was an exit was a gate that was locked because it was there for wandering residents.
Exactly.
So they could not.
They would exit. Have been trapped. If there was a fire, they would have been trapped and there would have been no survival. So one of the things, and again, this is something that my participation in the Air Force has taught me, that you have to think, the terminology in flight, flight school, is you have to stay ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. You have to know what your next move is before you have to make that next move. For example, in that particular room, and it's force of habit, but you have to practice it.
Practice, practice, practice.
You have to, okay, I noticed where the fire extinguisher was. I noticed where the men's room and ladies' room were. I noticed where all the door exits were. I noticed where the control device for fire alarm was. Well, but why would you care about where the fire alarm was? Because in the event there's a problem, I need to do something. And one of the things that we need to do is change the dynamic. How do I change the dynamic? Say somebody came in there, it was a mass shooter, God forbid, but just say, or some other kind of event. Pulling a fire alarm draws a lot of attention.
Absolutely.
Brings the fire department in, possibly turns on the sprinklers, possibly alerts the whole building something is not right. It's just changed the dynamic, increased your chances of surviving the situation. In a private home, where's the door? Where's the telephone? Is my cell phone available to me? Have I taken it out of my pocket? There are little things that you can do, and I pointed out, and most people never even thought of it. Pre-program your phone to 911 so that all you have to do is press send.
So what I want to point out here is that we're not talking about, you know, you can't prepare someone with a specific response to a specific scenario. What you're talking about is a mental practice that you go through in whatever setting you're in that makes you aware of these things. Can you, I'm going to force a word to you that you taught me. Can you talk to me about OODA? Did I say that correctly?
Yes. Back in the day in the 50s, when the first jet aircraft came into place in Korea, the average speed was somewhere around 300 to 500 miles an hour. If you get a bad guy and a good guy moving at 300 to 500 miles an hour towards each other, that's a combined speed of 1,000 miles an hour. By the time you've seen the bad guy, it's already too late. You're moving too fast to start thinking about what your options are. So a Air Force flight training pilot came up with something called the OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, and act. But that is not something you do in the moment. That is something you do before the moment arrives. Aircraft pilots are taught that. Combat aircraft pilots are taught that repeatedly so that their body, and it's called muscle memory, their muscle memory and their brain, once a series of indicators occur, they don't have to go into, okay, what do I do? Let me see, I could go out the back door, I could go out the front. No, automatically they go into a course of action to be evade the problem, avoid the problem. And that's what you have to do, and it should be part of the training.
And it can be, this is an inside game. It's a mental game that you want to work.
Absolutely.
And practice.
Absolutely.
I know that throughout my career in leading healthcare organizations and speaking, I'll do role play quite a bit. And I always have the saying that, you know, you can't wait until you're on the mount to deliver the sermon. The sermon on the mount, you know. When you're in the moment of the crisis, it's not time to pontificate. It's not time to philosophize. It's time to act.
Absolutely.
And in order to act, you have to have visualized it, prepared it, planned it. You showed a video, and again, we're not trying to prepare from, you know, the assassins where they jump out of a car and start firing guns. But who knows what environment anybody would be in? When you showed that video, my initial reaction, I think it was, the point is, do you drive forward? Do you back up? You know, you remember the video.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I thought it was a little off at first until I had a dialogue, a private message with one of my Facebook caregiver folks. And she talked about how she loved going out into the world, but her husband used to do all the driving. Excuse me. And now that he's a quadriplegic and is in an electric wheelchair, and I guess he could drive, but he doesn't. I mean, she gets him into their accessible vehicle, and she does the driving. And she says that she doesn't like going out into the world anymore, and it's not because of the effort. It's because she has to be the driver, and that was never her role in life. And she feels very uncertain as a driver out there in the world with, her words, not mine, you know, a ball and chain kind of, she can't move quickly anywhere. And she says, what if I had one of these bumping deals at Florida for a while? It was a big deal. They'd target rental cars,
right,
and they'd have little bumper accidents.
Still do.
And so I thought your example was a little bit off until she was telling me this. And again, it's not jumping out with Uzis and a drug cartel or anything like that, but it is a fear that she has, and a mental process she has to go through in order to get her to go out in the world. She says she visualizes these scenarios.
In the video that I showed you, which had a tragic ending, the entire event took 4 seconds, and I had the students or the attendees look at the clock. At 4 seconds, it was over. So you don't have time to decide, what should I do? The OODA part comes, how do I change the dynamic and increase my chances of survival? With that said, you have to say, and we're also, we don't want to cause conflict. We don't want to cause trouble. People come into an environment and they say, I don't want to cause any more confusion. Well, sometimes you do. And sometimes your best chances of survival are causing confusion. So in, and I asked, okay, here's, let's do it one step by step. What would you do? And I knew everybody was going to say, and they did, I'd run over the people in front of the car. I would hit the car in front of me because that's the bad guy's car. And I said, okay, that's an option. What are the consequences of that option? And everybody said, well, we could possibly survive it. I said, no, you've just decreased your chance of survival. Why? You hit the front of your car. You've caused your airbags to deploy, caused your car to shut down because that's what it's supposed to do when the airbags deploy, and you've reduced your risk of survival. Put it in reverse and go as hard as you can and either do a reverse turn or hit the car behind you. You've changed the dynamics. If a person's trying to assault you, the last thing they want is more commotion. If the person in behind you has airbags, they're going to deploy and they'll be safe. You've caused you've changed the OODA loop.
You've broken you've recreated the OODA loop, and you've created a OODA loop for the other party.
They now have to say, "Oh my, this person just altered my plans. What do I do?" You've bought seconds, and sometimes that's all that's required. In addition, part of what that OODA loop is the planning part. And, you know, it was funny because only about 72 hours before I gave that presentation, I was called in the middle of the night to visit with a client at Temple Hospital. And a little plug for me.
Yeah.
The organization that requested me to do that, they said, you're the only attorney who would get up in the middle of the night and go find somebody in a hospital. So
I take a brief sidebar to talk about one of the reasons I wanted you on this podcast? Again, this podcast is called The Caregivers, and I get this a lot. You know, people have a very narrow definition of the term caregivers. Mine is very broad, and I'm trying to create broadened awareness of all aspects of caregivers. And one of the things that I do know about you is that this whole safety thing has many levels to it, some of which are beyond the scope of this podcast. But you have not just gone out in the middle of the night to help that client, but you've built this training that you do about caregiver safety with zero monetization in mind. I mean, this is a passion of yours to share the message.
This is,
and what comes of it comes of it. But that's a very caregiver thing when you're deferring your own needs to the benefit of others.
This has nothing to do with money. This has to do with the love I have for my wife, the respect I have for what she did most of her career, and what has been taken away, not from her, because we're ending, she just retired 3 weeks ago. Not
good for her.
It's not going to be taken away from her, but all those young people who won't follow in her footsteps because, as you pointed out, it's the second highest rate of assault and it's needed. I mean, her position, her place, the things that she needs, someone has to come after her. Someone has to come after and do the things that she did. With that class and jumping back into what we were talking about and the preparation, I show up at Temple Hospital and the sun is just coming up. And I realize that it's very likely I will be at the hospital for a good maybe 15, 10, 12 hours. So it might be dark. It was in the late winter.
it might be dark when I leave. I went two levels above where the first available parking space was. I parked next to the door, checked to see if there was an overhead light. There was. And to see if my vision observation angle would be such that I would be able to see my car if I had to leave Temple Hospital in the middle of the night. These are the things you do in preparation. It was funny, and why I say it's funny is because when I did it, I never thought about it and thought about the seminar I was about to give, and I walked to the door and then came back. I said, no, this is too good. I have to come back and take some pictures and show the class. This is a way of life. It is not something you do at the spur of the moment. It's something you do and you have to incorporate. One of my mentors in this kind of pursuit said, start with your children. Play a game. Okay. We're in the car. As you're driving down the road, say, okay, we're going to start the game. And then wait 2 or 3 minutes and say, tell me what the color of the car was. Tell me what the license plate number was. Tell me what this was. So that you have your children trained to keep their wits about them and know what's going on around them. It's a useful skill. It was developed with thousands of hours of your taxpayer dollars. And it's something that most people, when you say OODA, have no clue what you're talking about.
Sure.
But it's an easy Google.
So a different OODA type of approach is that caregivers are so focused on the people they care for. They do all of this to anticipate anything that might occur to the person that they're taking care of, but they don't do these things to anticipate and preserve their own safety.
Absolutely.
In many ways. Now, I'm going to come to you in a minute and ask you to think of a "you might be a caregiver if" statement that could describe a scenario where the caregiver is, you know, thinking of others rather than themselves. It's kind of a funny little thing, and I'm giving you a warning because I don't want to put you on the spot for that. While you're doing that, I always talk about caregiver distortions. I always try and focus one during the podcast. And in listening to you talk, I'm going to pick caregiver distortion number 5. Now, these come from many sources, but I like to quote Dr. David Burns and his The Feeling Good Handbook. And the point of this is when you're stressed or preoccupied, you tend to not think clearly. They call it stinking thinking. One of the distortions is jumping to conclusions, where you make a negative interpretation, even though there are no definitive facts that convincingly support your conclusion. Now, we do this a lot in our lives, to think negatively about a situation or ourselves. This is a case where that might actually help us if we can apply that to the OODA discussion of any potentially negative or dangerous situation that we're going in. So it might be the one area where a distortion, but tweaked in a way that can be helpful, could be to our advantage.
Absolutely. You don't suppress, in situational ethics, you do not suppress your prejudices. You let them work to your advantage. It's much like the Asian Oriental arts of fighting. You don't push yourself into the punch. You loosen up, you relax so that the punch does not have as much effect. You take your prejudices and predispositions into account. Doesn't mean you follow them and you become to the nth degree. It just means you take them into account. But you also have to take into account your culture, the environment of the culture that you're in. So what are my presumptions when I walk in, and how do they not match? And let's be a little off color, but if being a little off color,
it's always fun to.
Okay, if I'm a little off color, hey, I'm an old white bald dude. Okay, plain and simple. I walk into an African American household, or an Indian, Indian household. What I see, hear, and smell is going to be radically different than my Italian cultural heritage. So I take my Italian cultural heritage and try to understand the cultural heritage in which I'm walking in and put the two together.
Right.
Will that happen overnight? No. You've got to want to learn. And you said, what a caregiver is? A caregiver is a person who wants to reach out to the rest of the world, not in a judgmental way, but in a way of caregiving.
Oh, it's a very vulnerable way because you put yourself out there
absolutely.
To serve others and you're
absolutely.
Not thinking of yourself.
Absolutely. And then you put the two, once you've put the two together and say, well, am I reacting to this event because of my prejudices? Oh, yeah, I am. Okay. Well, then discount those. Or am I aware enough to know that that's not a threat? So it's an educational process, one that's unfortunately in the caregiver business is not being taught in school. And we have become so politically correct that we can't embrace our differences. We have to all kind of be on the same page. And that's wrong because my Italian household, I'll give you a quick example. This is a little off the rails, but it's a little example. In an Italian household, if there is a very small pot of soup on the table and someone walks in an Italian household, you invite them to eat at your table. There may not be enough food. There's always going to be enough food in an Italian household. There will be. We'll make it work. But if you are the guest, your first response is to say, no, 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 I choose not to have dinner. Thank you very much for the invitation. If the homeowner says to you again, no, we want you to stay for dinner, then you accept on the second invitation. A cultural difference.
Yeah.
Most people don't realize that. And it came up in the office not too long ago about an Italian family that didn't do that. And I just said, oh, that is so not Italian.
Yeah.
But it's going to be different in an African-American home. It's going to be different in an Irish home. It's going to be different. Learn those differences. Embrace the differences.
I don't know if this has anything to do with what occurred. And this is a 30-some-year-old, oh, gosh, it's more like a 35-year-old story. But when I was in my clinical rotations in nursing school, I was in a OBGYN setting, labor and delivery, what have you. And I went in to care for a woman who was of a different culture, and she offered me some food. And I didn't accept it because I was caught up in a distorted thought, like it would be unprofessional for me to accept food. I'm a new professional. I'm learning my role as a nurse, and I shouldn't be eating people's food. Well, I should have, because in rejecting her invitation and offer, I offended her, and it was very visible how things changed at that moment. I want to talk about something. We're not in any rush here, but I feel that if I don't move in, I'm going to come back to you for a "you might be a caregiver if" statement. If you've got one, let me know. You just raise your hand or bounce up and down, because I've got one for you if you don't come up with one. But I would be remiss if I didn't bring this up. When we're talking about caregiver safety and we're talking about the likelihood in the workplace of a caregiver to be the victim of violence or abuse or assault, there's very high likelihood that it is a caregiver that is committing that assault, a stressed family member who is upset about the scenario or is there with their loved one or what have you. We can, the term caregiver doesn't mean automatically that we're angels. You know, it means yeah. that we're both vulnerable from others and vulnerable to our own emotions. And, you know, you can't prepare for those emotions. But I just wanted to put out there that when the thing that I try and talk about is caregiver distortions and handling your stress and the whole thing about my bear, Doc, the defender of caregivers on the side of the van, that nobody understands is that to me, what Doc is a calm, rational version of myself. It is the version of myself that I can channel through this preparation that you're discussing on the specific issue of safety. But it's a broader perspective as well.
Wow. This is a flood of things I'd like to say and probably won't have the time to. A, caregivers are not paid enough.
Absolutely.
B, caregivers are not given societal recognition enough. C, caregivers, like psychologists and psychiatrists, are asked on a daily basis to take on the cares and woes of the less fortunate. That is a burden I, as a practicing attorney, can understand a little bit, but could never understand it to the extent of my wife, especially when she started getting into hospice-type care. Every one of her clients share one thing in common. They are going to die in the near. My wife is going to get attached to them.
Yes.
And they are then going to leave her.
Yes.
If that doesn't cause stress, very little else will. So, how come our society, in providing us with caregivers and training these wonderful people... I'm going to say that again because you coughed.
Yeah, excuse me.
Training these wonderful people doesn't provide for them an outlet where they can de-stress, explain, have a community group where almost like an AA, if it be that, or private counseling where they have to be deprogrammed, turn it off. Because most of the caregivers that I've ever encountered wake up in the morning at 8 a.m., and they're a caregiver. Come home at 5 o'clock, they're a caregiver.
Oh, yeah.
And go to bed, this is the worst part, at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock or whatever time they go to bed, and they're still a caregiver. You don't turn caregiving off.
Right.
It is part of who you are. You're a nurturing person. You are a caregiver if you are, by nature, a nurturing person.
So one of the observations I have as you're talking, you talk about like a support group or a way to, you know, decompress from that or what have you. I know that in the professional caregiver world, one of the ways that that is done is through a morbidly twisted sixth sense of humor that most people can't even begin to comprehend. What I worry about is the personal family caregiver that doesn't have a natural network that's out there. They turn to places like the internet, what have you. They have to stay angry or upset. Excuse me, these allergies are killing me. I got to learn how to kill this mic for a second. I don't know how to do that yet. I'm new to this.
You got a little kill switch.
But one of the things that I talk about over and over again, and probably will in every podcast because adult learning requires repetition, is I talk about the caregiver gap. And the caregiver gap is where we go from guilt to anger to a proper relationship. And I just say that, you know, caregivers have a lot of guilt on both angles of this because they can't make things better. Your wife in hospice, a lot of people outside of that will say, well, she knew what she was getting into. But it's still, you can't past that. There's always that guilt. Anger is actually a good thing because it's a progression on the emotional scale towards status quo. But anger can slip over into violence sometimes. This has become circular, but it is a very real thing. Everyone... the idea of using what is normally a distortion of jumping to conclusions to visualize the scenario that you're about to be in before you're in it.
Absolutely.
And try and be prepared to address it no matter which side of this you're on.
Or you should have someone walk you through it. When I mean, as silly as this may sound, I started my working as an HVAC technician.
Really?
And yeah.
Before
law school. That's, I should have probably stayed there, but I didn't.
We need service people.
HVAC, they don't talk back to you. Clients do, okay? But as it were, when I went out to the field, my manager would say, okay, when you get there, it's going to be a A73.6 compressor. This is what you should expect to find, and this is what it'll expect to do. An HVAC technician gets a walkthrough. A caregiver gets show up at Jones's house at 9:15, not knowing what to expect other than perhaps a diagnosis or something. That's not fair. They should get a walkthrough. This is in a neighborhood. This is in a type of neighborhood. This is an African-American family. This is a there's three people living there. So they have an idea, and this should be an idea of what they're walking into before they get there. And as importantly, the most of these caregivers, okay, you're not going to like this. Most of these caregivers come from agencies. It should be incumbent on the agency that sends them to give them a full briefing and then occasionally a debriefing. Okay, when you got there, what did you see? What happened? What did you do? Every time a police officer is involved in an altercation, they are debriefed. Every time a pilot comes back from a sortie in the military, they are debriefed. Yeah. What did you see?
It is such a fast-paced environment. None of this is an excuse on behalf of the professional side of things, but it's such a fast-paced environment, and there's such a lack of available caregivers in so many settings that a lot of those things are overlooked. But the biggest reason why a lot of those things are overlooked is we haven't quite gotten to the awareness yet of what we're really asking these folks to do. You mentioned a police or a pilot. They have a debriefing because everybody knows, hey, that's a hell of a traumatic thing that these people were just asked to do. We don't think that way about caregivers. We just think that it's natural. It's them. They want to do it. It is very traumatic. It is very...
Okay.
Even good experiences are emotionally challenging.
One of the things when I was an HVAC technician, to me, that was a job. When I became a lawyer, it became part of who I am. And when I say that, I mean a caregiver doesn't just go to a job. They have just given part of their soul, as I have given part of my soul to my what I do as an attorney. A little bit of my soul goes with each one of my clients. And for a caregiver, it's even more so because I have to force myself to stay unemotional. You can't do that as a caregiver.
Yeah.
You can't stay unemotional because you see what these people are going through. And I... In the words of Winston Churchill, sweat, blood, and tears. You see the sweat, blood, and tears of these folks. So you get emotional. So you're saying to me, and I'm trying to help, you're asking an individual to give part of their soul to a family they don't know and not offer them the support. That's just unconscionable.
Yeah.
That's why, as you put it out earlier, I have no interest in making money doing this, helping caregivers, because I've seen my wife do it. I've seen her lose part of her soul every time one of her clients that she fell in love with, no, wasn't supposed to, passed away.
Yeah. Well, this kind of training, I mean, eventually, whether you like it or not, we'll talk. Don't worry about this. Podcasts are live, and we'll talk about that. I want you to maybe give a shout out to your new friend there. The professional side of this, the corporate side of this, is seeing more and more the need for this type of training. A lot of people are worried about active shooters and that sort of thing, and there's a lot of training for that, and thank God for it. But this type of training, this type of safety training, the inside game, is something that is starting to get more and more attention. So whether you like it or not, you'll probably end up making money eventually with this. Tell me about your friend here.
My friend is, okay, words of wisdom. This is life lesson number, I think, 419. So make note of this because I've got the all 400 and up to 419 cataloged. We had a wonderful dog who was ours for about 9 years, and he passed away last July. And my wife in October asked me if I would be kind enough to just take a ride out to the SPCA. After 7 or 8 or 146 times saying no, we finally went to the SPCA. This is tip 212. If your wife wants to go to the SPCA, just do it. It's just so much easier. So we did. And we didn't see any dogs that we fell in love with. I didn't want to get another dog. And then they said, we have one guy in quarantine, and he's just coming out of quarantine, and but he's big. And I said, I wasn't about it. Yeah. But he came out. He pushed me over. He was licking my face. And the dog behavior person said to the person behind the counter, start writing him up. He's gone home with them. And he has been our dog mascot ever since. It's what the neat part about this guy is, uh-huh. Just a real sideline, he's incredibly empathic. Okay. And part two is,
dogs are caregivers too.
Yeah, oh, well, that's what I was going to say. This guy, he's very empathic, and he had separation anxiety, so I started taking him to work, and that was only supposed to be for a few weeks. Now it's been a year.
And his name?
His name was Gotti. And it took me, okay, there's a little backstory on that one too. His name was Gotti. I'm an attorney. I said, that's not for a
Gotti, as in Godfather Gotti?
That's what we originally thought, Gotti. But it took me about 3 months to figure out after we changed his name to Puccini.
Puccini. I was going to say, did you change it to Gambino?
Yeah, Gambino. We changed it to Puccini, a.k.a. Pooh. So his nickname is Pooh. And it took me 3 months to figure out that Gotti is dog spelled backwards.
Oh.
And whoever had him. So when we got him, he had a broken leg, heartworm disease, and or I should say after quarantined, heartworm disease, Giardia. And yeah. Giardia is a disease that if this is listened to by caregivers, you're going to know what it is, so I'm not going to explain it.
Pooh is delightful. He is big. I'd estimate him right around 100 pounds. He is a salt and pepper. Is he full-bred German Shepherd?
He's a full-bred German Shepherd. And I said the part about it being empathic. If I don't come to work, I have people call me and ask me if I could just bring the dog over. But one of the things that we found is his job, it seems to be, if he finds, believe it or not, attorneys can be sensitive, and attorneys can be get clients who have major life-altering problems, and we try to help them. Especially in my practice, that's what I enjoy doing most. He understands that, and we had a case where a woman came in and couldn't get through her life story, the story that we needed to hear, without crying. Puccini immediately gravitated to her and sat beside her, and she petted him the entire time she was telling the story and helped her get through the story. And as soon as she was finished the story, he got up and left. But no one even noticed, and she thanked us profusely as she was leaving the building. She says, thank you for having the therapy dog here. And I said, yeah, that's what he was, a therapy dog.
Well, tell you, a dog is good for your Q rating. The Q rating is the measure of how the public knows you or perceives you. My rescue Chance is much more popular and likable than I will ever be. So I think getting Pooh was a great move for your life, your business, what have you. So do you have a "you might be a caregiver if" statement for me?
Yes. You might be a caregiver. I think I like that soul part. I think if you are prepared to share your soul with someone else, you might be a caregiver.
Okay. I was developing one as we listened. Now, I've been doing these a long time, so don't get jealous if mine's better than yours. I'm not judging, but you might be a caregiver if you're willing to put your own safety at risk to preserve that of another. And we want to work on that. That is a natural tendency. We want to talk about situational awareness. We want to see things before they happen. We want to learn what you talked about, the OODA loop. We want to, you know, visualize. I think Boo's telling us it's time to close the podcast. He's starting to chew on a bone loudly. So one of the things I do that is the most awkward part of the podcast, and you do not have to join me in this, is I finish by saying the caregiver's vow. So if you'd like to join me, the caregiver's vow, and he's grabbing his glasses. Please learn and repeat after me.
Time out. I have to get these old people glasses.
Focused?
They're focused now.
Okay.
Please learn and repeat after me.
I'm proud of who I am. What
I am. I am a caregiver.
I live in awareness
that I take satisfaction in pleasing others and sometimes overcommit. I accept that some things I cannot change and that I am not perfect. I will allow others to help and join me on my caregiver's journey. I will honor myself as I care for others. This is my solemn caregiver's vow.
And in closing, I'd like to say I will see things before they occur as I take care of my own safety. And I'd also like to say in closing, Pietro, Peter, if that's
Pietro is
more preferred, you might be a caregiver. Thank you for caring.
It's my pleasure. And if I can do anything, like I said, I'm committed to this because I saw my wife grow and become the person who I adore. Did I say that after 41 years? Okay, forget that. I like her a lot, actually. The person I adore develop through becoming a caregiver and taking every – and for your audience – she's taken everything good about being a caregiver and brought it into, internalized it, and has made her the beauty, the soul beauty, the not the external, but the internal beauty that she is. And if it can do that for her, it certainly can do that for any caregiver. But they are blessed individuals.
Peter, thank you for caring.
There you go. Thanks for being us for what might have been a slightly off-topic episode in the minds of some. Sometimes when I travel around the country to speak at family caregiver conferences or professional healthcare conferences, the family caregiver side are initially taken aback because their entire focus is on caring for others, and my entire focus is helping them with a perspective and an appreciation of caring for themselves. And they're hesitant to listen to and absorb messages like this because their focus is on others. It's for this reason that I really enjoyed this podcast and these occasional podcasts where I take us on a detour. Being a caregiver, whether professional or personal, makes us vulnerable because we are exposed to others. We cannot control our personal space, and perhaps most importantly, the perspective that we have. We see the world through binoculars, where our world and vision becomes smaller and smaller and more focused on our tasks, our duties, our jobs, or our roles. And my hope is that podcasts such as this with an eccentric man like Pietro Barbieri might help provide a broader perspective on your own personal caregiver safety. Thanks again for listening. Please leave us a 5-star review. But most importantly, please share this podcast with others that you think might benefit from these caregiver stories. Okay, everyone, go out there, do what you do, be good, and honor yourself as you care for others because you might be a caregiver. Thank you for caring. Bye-bye now.